paper transitions most efficiently into the classic six-sided bushy snowflakes, those big dendrites that we get. And if there's strong upwards motion, so lift, within this layer, you can get a high ratio of liquid to snow ratio, right? So the snow tends to be fluffy and that'll pile up very quickly. Convective snows, like lake effect snows, ocean effect snows, those tend to have a high, the liquid to snow ratio is very, very high, whereas heavy wet snows are very low because they're not as fluffy. So that's something that's also looked at because that affects larger snowflakes have a better chance at surviving when they go through melt zones. Let me drop it. Now, there are a few ways that these a warm nose or these melting layers can be overcome, and this is where it gets really difficult for meteorologists. So the question is, how is warm air cool to allow snow, right? So sometimes the forecast will say rain, but then it starts snowing, and you're wondering what's happening. Well, what might be happening is something called diabatic cooling, right? So there's a few different types of cooling. With evaporative cooling, if the air near the ground is dry, precipitation evaporates as it falls, and the evaporation process, it removes heat from the air, and that can drop the temperature to the wet bulb, which I've discussed before here on the ScienceNet, and so it'll drop it to the wet temperature, which may be below freezing, in the winter it often is. And as a result of that, the effects of the evaporative cooling basically cool the column or this glob of air down to or below the freezing mark, and now the snow doesn't melt. You also have melting cooling, which occurs, and this is where you take energy, so it takes energy heat to melt snow. So if you have a heavy burst of snow that falls through a warm layer, it basically steals heat from the air. So if the snow is heavy enough, it can eventually cool the entire layer down to the freezing mark, or at least drop the temperature enough that it survives with minimal or basically no melting, and suddenly your what was a cold rain or ice pellets or whatever it was turns into a heavy wet snow. That's what happens. And then the other thing that we can also get is frontal deformation or vertical stretching, right? So in some cases, depending on what's happening with the air mass, the entire column can sort of get stretched vertically, and that it's minuscule, but that stretching does cool the temperature, right? Because if you look at noble gases and other things like that, if you compress a gas, it heats up. When you decompress it, it cools down. So this is the same thing happening on a much larger scale. It's not as significant. Evaporative cooling and melting melt cooling, that has far more of a greater effect. Let me drop it. And that's why meteorologists look at diabatic cooling, right? That's why it's important for precipitation type. So that's just a quick breakdown. And, of course, meteorologists will sort of try and track what's going on based on what the radar says, what the observations are from the ground. The most important reports are the observations from the ground, since those ones actually tell you what's going on. But things do change. Rain will turn into snow. Snow can turn into rain, seemingly without much warning. And again, that's because the amount of data we have above the ground is minuscule compared to the amount of data we have at the ground. But the data at the ground doesn't really tell us what's going on above us, right? We know it's windy here, but it's not windy, or the wind is blowing from a different direction aloft. And one last example for you that I wanted to drop out here. So what is today? The 27th. So yesterday we had a snowstorm blow through, let's say, and it was a mix of snow and then ice pellets and then ice pellets and snow. And it was one of these things where I said, oh, this is interesting, because we had big, big fluffy snowflakes just pounding down and very hard, clear ice pellets. And the ice pellets were raindrops that are refrozen solid. And it's very unusual to have raindrops and snow or ice pellets and snow fall concurrently at such high volumes. And I said, what's going on here? So this was something interesting. Let me cycle it. So the snowflakes were snowflakes in general, they fall at various speeds, but the most common speed is about 1 meter a second. the ice pellets, they fall somewhere between 3 and 5 meters a second. And if we assume, so what was happening was that the system was moving to the east. So the system's motion was easterly or east-northeasterly. The winds at the surface were actually out of the east. So what does that mean? Well, they're blowing from east to west. So in the lowest kilometer, the lowest 1,000, well, a little bit more, but let's just say the lowest 1,000 meters, the winds were easterly. So the snow aloft was moving to the east. It was falling and then being blown back to the west. Now, because the snow falls at a slower, it has a slower terminal velocity than the ice pellets, the ice pellets, to fall a kilometer, 1,000 meters, they needed between 333 seconds and like 10 minutes or so. So they would get down to the ground in about, let's say, 10 minutes or less. Whereas the snow took about 20 minutes or sorry, not 20 minutes. It had the ability to move 20 kilometers, that's what I was trying to say. The ice pellets could only travel about 7 kilometers at most before they hit the ground, whereas the snowflakes could travel 20 kilometers. So the snow, the heavy snow, was being blown so far back to the west that it was actually sneaking under the warm layer and falling with the ice pellets that were falling closer to my head, right? Whereas the snow was coming all the way from much further east and being blown to the west. And that's why, at least in part, I suspect that we had this mix of snow and rain, mix of snow and ice pellets at the same time with equal veracity. And I sort of correlated with the radar. And I said, "Oh yeah, that's interesting, and it makes sense." So I suspect that's what was going on. I looked at it with the balloon sounding data and some of the model of the real time model analysis data, and it indicated that's likely what was happening. Anyway, that's my theory and hypothesis on that. Okay, Ken, I don't know if there are any comments or questions. I'll send it back to you. VA3VWX.
And this is VA3KX. Thanks so much for that, Tom. Any stations out there, if you have a comment for Tom, question, anything like that, come on in. Or if you're just checking in, come on in too.
Check in from Kilo Zero Romeo Oscar Sierra.
I'm just checking in, or did you have a comment for Tom? All right, I think I doubled there with the station. If you'd like to try and come in one more time.
It's Victor Alpha 3 India Alpha Hotel, Allen in Ottawa. Just checking in.
Okay, I've got you, Alan. Thanks for joining us. Any further check-ins or any further check-ins and comments for Tom? Come on in. All right, thanks for that again this week, Tom, the climate update. As usual, very informative. Thank you so much for that. I know you put a lot of time and effort into that for us. Thank you so much. And I guess now we'll move on with the rest of the net. Once again, thanks, Tom. And in the sky this week, and then after this, the science trivia corner. Oh, and before we in the sky this week, reminds me, we're talking, Tom was talking about the weather and warming and et cetera, et cetera. The sun over periods of time will definitely have an effect on the warming of our planet. Just about roughly every billion years of the sun's diameter, it increases by about 10%. That's just simply because of the hydrogen conversion into helium, and it starts to expand. The outer shell pushes out. So it's in a phase now of depleting its hydrogen. So you've got solar warming, that's going to increase by about 8% about every billion years. And every century you're looking at, it's 8.0 times 10 to the exponent minus 7. increases in solar warming. And every million years, it's 8.0 times 10 to the exponent minus 3. So it's not a lot, but it does contribute. But I just thought I'd throw that in there, the contribution of the sun and how it warms our planet. And as the hydrogen gets converted, it's converted to helium. Helium is more is denser than hydrogen, so it gets accumulated in the core of the sun, which is doing now. And as it does, it creates more gravity, and that gravity causes further compression. That compression produces heat, and that's what causes the sun to expand and to get hotter. As the hydrogen is being converted into helium, the helium compresses more and more, and as it compresses more and more, it produces more and more heat. All right. In the sky this week. And the only thing I think of mentioning this week is, and it's still being followed, and they're still trying to get as much information and much data as they can from it, is 3I Atlas. And this was, is, an interstellar object. And it's now basically on its journey out of our solar system. It's, oh my goodness, it's been observed multiple times and with some of the most sophisticated equipment available to science. And even using some of the most powerful telescopes ever made, even robotic probes on Mars. And the object, it appears as an amorphous cloud of gas. It's wrapped in this sort of continuing mystery. They still don't know a lot about it. They have gathered some information, but they still don't know a lot about it. What is known about it is that it's a comet. It originated somewhere within our galaxy, but where? They don't really know. Its age, size, and composition, still poorly defined. But they do know it's a comet. Of what nature, they're really not sure yet. Just dropping. And scientists, they still are suggesting, before it's long gone, that it be intercepted with a spacecraft to gather some defining information, but nothing has been determined about that. Going back to July 1st, scientists at the Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Blast Alert System, ATLAS, they announced they had spotted something mysterious heading our way. And at that time, it was beyond the orbit of Jupiter, and it was traveling at just over 130,000 miles per hour, 210,000 kilometers an hour. And ATLAS at that time was scanning the skies using a telescope situated in Hawaii, and it was looking for potentially hazardous objects. Well, they certainly weren't expecting to find what they found with this new object. Only three of these interstellar objects have been detected in reportable times. So something very new, and they're still trying to gather as much information as they can about it. Because if they can, it'll give them some very interesting information about how the early galaxy formed, and even hopefully a little bit more about dark matter and its influence on the early development of the universe. And I'll pause here for a moment to see if there are any check-ins or any comments. And then after this, the Science Trivia Corner. And for those of you unfamiliar with that part of the net, or this part of the net, it's a two-parter. One is a quiz. The other is just some straight trivia. And the quiz really isn't a quiz in the true sense of a quiz. It's just dressed-up trivia to make it a little bit more interesting and fun. So it's not anything, it's not a test of knowledge, anything like that. It's just a little bit of trivia dressed up to make it a little bit more fun. If you'd like to join us, come on in. And there's a station trying to come in. Far too much noise. Audio is way too low. If you want to try again, maybe position yourself. I don't know what you can do, but try again, see if you can come in, maybe turn your power up.
Yeah, I turned the power up a bit. Victor Echo 7 Tango, Echo Tango, just for an early in and out. Thanks for the check-in if you do copy.
Yeah, I most certainly did. I got you that time.
Okay, thanks. This is Chuck in Fifth Meadows.
I think it's just cold outside. It's not raining.
Yeah, and I'm transmitting here from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and it's cold out tonight. There's a little bit of a wind out there, which makes it a little bit worse. I think this afternoon, Tom, if he's still listening, he might be able to correct me. I don't know if I've got the right figures on this. I think it was about -6 at one point with the wind chill. A little bit of wind chill there dropped it down to about minus 11, so it was a little chilly.